Okay, here we are. Welcome to Blogging Heads TV. I'm Arnold Kling.
And I'm Mark Toma.
And I don't know about you, Mark, but I feel like I've got a face that was made for radio.
Well, I haven't been told that directly, but I probably have the same face.
So I guess we're going to talk about our respective points of view on macroeconomics, which are different. You might even say mine are all over the map, because I've been all over the map on macroeconomics. But I thought maybe we'd start by talking a little bit about our careers on the web, since I think we've both made very active use of the web. In my opinion, Mark's blog, Economist View, is one of the most valuable, if not the most valuable, weblog, economics weblog on the web.
Well,
and you've also done a lot of recording of your lectures, right?
Yeah, I put up all my video lectures online. I have a YouTube channel, and so just my undergraduate ones. But yeah, I've been experimenting with that, seeing if students still come to class or not. And they seem to.
Yeah, I actually did something like that. I ended up sort of podcasting lectures, and I have them up on my website, maybe in an obscure spot for when I taught at George Mason University. But I also have some podcasts for my advanced placement statistics class, and I think those are better. I think those work better than my economics podcasts. But I think we're both kind of early adopters. I've had an economics weblog for many years, and you're a violation of the economics axiom that people are just self-interested, because you were really putting up a lot of public goods on your website.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I don't have any ads or anything. I figured somebody has to do it. If everyone says they're public goods, it doesn't get done. So 4 years ago, after the last election, I was a little dissatisfied with the way things were going out there, what I was hearing in the news. So I decided just to start writing a blog and see what happened. I certainly never expected it ended up here.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a great resource.
Well, thank you. Yours is too. I enjoy reading it.
All right. So shall we get into our topics?
Sure. I think we're going to start off. I know we want to start by macro, but I know when we were at a recent Kansas City conference on blogging and some other things, you had expressed some concerns about the size of government. So I thought maybe we could talk about that a little bit first and then kind of move into macroeconomics after we do that. So I don't know if you'd like to start. You certainly can if you'd like on this, and then I'll throw a few words in and we'll go from there.
All right. Well, I've got certainly a lot to say about my concerns about the size of government. In fact, I have a book that will be out maybe in about August on this issue. And the tentative title of the book is Unchecked and Unbalanced, and then the subtitle is something like The Concentration of Government Power in an Age of Dispersed Knowledge. So what I'm thinking is, you know, in this medium, the Internet, we see a lot of dispersed knowledge. I mean, people like you and I are blogging heads. We would never be talking heads in a broadcast TV environment. I've certainly never been a TV talking head. I'm not sure I'd want to be.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of dispersed information out there, and yet our political power is becoming more concentrated. And actually the first example that I can think of inappropriate concentration of power with dispersed knowledge, I think it actually has something to do with the subprime and financial crisis. I think a lot of executives at financial institutions had accumulated a lot of power, but didn't really understand the financial instruments that they were working with, and that knowledge was dispersed. And so coming back to my concern about government, I think the situation is even worse there. Those of us ordinary citizens have lots of knowledge, it's dispersed, but the power is heavily concentrated, and I think that that's going to lead to increasingly bad and anomalous outcomes, particularly as the tendency seems to be for the concentration of power to be ever greater, even as knowledge is becoming more dispersed. So that's my quick pitch on that one.
So, you know, I'm with you on the concentration of power, particularly in the financial industry. That's not really government per se, but anywhere a concentration of power happens, I think we need to be concerned. And so some of the ways the government's behaved in recent years with the concentration of power in the executive branch and other sorts of things, I think we're seeing a concentration of power in the Fed, in Washington, rather than the way the system was initially put forth, which is shared power across the 12 banks. You know, I realize they need to consolidate power somewhat, but I wonder if they haven't gone too far. On the general issue, I think the way we got into talking about this initially was you were concerned about the Obama administration and what that would mean for the size of government. And the first point I wanted to make is there's really no necessary relationship between stabilization policy, which is what I talk a lot about, using government spending or tax cuts or monetary policy even to stabilize the government, but with fiscal policy, there's no real necessary relationship between fiscal policy and the size of government. I think a lot of people get that wrong. You could, for instance, increase government spending every time there's a bad time, increase taxes to pay for it in the good times. If you keep doing that, government spending goes up, taxes go up, G goes up, T goes up, government gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think we've seen some of that kind of bloating in the past. You can manage stabilization policy by cutting taxes to stimulate the economy when things are bad, and cutting government in the good times to pay for it, government spending. And if you do it that way, the size of government gets smaller. So there's no real connection between stabilization policy necessarily and the size of government. I think a lot of people think that if we do stabilization policy, we'll end up with this huge government. Nevertheless, I think the government probably will get bigger, and I'm not so upset about it as you probably are, because I think the main thing driving that is health care. So if the government gets bigger because we bring health care under the government's wing, that's not something I'm going to be too concerned about. But if, in fact, it just bloats, if we do all this spending in the recession, and when the good times come and it comes time to pay for it, and we can't make the hard political choices to actually pay for it by cutting spending or raising taxes or some combination, and government does, in fact, get bigger and bigger every time we try to do stabilization policy, then I'm pretty concerned about it myself. And let me stop. Just pause there.
Okay, well, I think we'll probably agree to disagree on that one. You're less cynical than I am about even the motives of stabilization policy.
Yeah.
I sometimes think that the stabilization policy is becoming an excuse for expansion of government, whereas, you know, you're right. In principle, you could have government spending, you know, go up and down countercyclically without having any general trend whatsoever. I mean, that's true in principle, and I'm glad that you're going to fight for that in practice, but I plan to.
You know, these statements that a crisis is an opportunity to do what? You need a goal. You don't just take an opportunity because it's there. There's an optimal size of government. See, I think government should equalize opportunity, promote macro stability, and solve market failures. And when they start going beyond those key roles, and they're doing it in ways that maybe, you know, you question, then I think, you know, we both should get on them about their size. But anyway, yeah. That's where I'm at.
Okay. What was your next topic?
Well, we were going to move on, I think, to macro models. And I know that's a big topic of yours, and you've got a lot of dissatisfaction with macroeconomics. You're probably more dissatisfied with the core of it than I am, so maybe... if you want to go first, that's fine, then I'll add my two cents, and once again, we can probably just go from there. So,
okay, well, let me. This may take a while, but I want to go over kind of my own personal history with this. The very first economics course I took was not a micro course, but it was a macro course. It was taught by Frank Pearson at Swarthmore College, the fall of 1971, and he used an unusual textbook. The textbook used actual specific numbers for equations. So it wasn't, you know, like a consumption function. It was an equation that said C equals something plus something else and so on. It was very specific numbers. So it was the impression was that there was a lot of reality to that. You know, these were real numbers corresponding to the U.S. economy. And the picture that you got was that that macroeconomics was something like applied physics or engineering. You know, I've since, you know, seen the movie Apollo 13, one of my favorite movies, and if you remember that, you know, the spaceship is damaged, and then they need to get it back to Earth, and they've got to use the laws of physics and so on. And one of their decisions is that they can't just stop the spacecraft and reverse it to get it coming back toward Earth. They need the pull of the moon's gravity, so they've got to go around the moon and use the moon's gravity to change the direction of the spacecraft. So there's all this. So they're applying the laws of physics, and they've got a little bit to work with in terms of thrusters to try to change the attitude of the ship, change the direction, and they've got a little bit in, and they've got a little bit of rocket power to really push it toward Earth. And that's kind of the picture that was painted in the late 60s of the economy, is that, you know, we had these laws with constants and specific numbers, and we have these the equivalent of the thrusters and the rockets, where fiscal policy, that's government spending and tax cuts, and monetary policy, that's the Federal Reserve intervening in money markets to change interest rates. And with those sort of thrusters and rockets, and knowing the laws of macroeconomics, the supposed laws, we could, you know, direct the economy the way NASA was able to direct Apollo 13 back home. And I just think that's very misleading on a lot of levels. We don't have that kind of precision. My line is that it's sort of like if Isaac Newton were writing down the economics laws every day. Every day he was working on those, on the economics laws, every night God would come in and erase what he wrote and write completely new laws that were completely different. I just don't think that we have anywhere near that level of precision. That's jumping ahead a bit. So there I was in freshman macroeconomics. I'm very excited.
Can I back up for a second here?
Yeah, sure.
So just in case anyone here doesn't really understand the distinction between macroeconomics and microeconomics, in macroeconomics what we want to do is try to determine what makes all prices go up or down simultaneously, or for the most part, what makes most output from all firms go up or down simultaneously, what makes unemployment go up or down simultaneously. So what we do is we invent these aggregates that are supposed to represent those concepts. We have this thing called a price level that captures the average price. We have GDP, which essentially captures average output. We track unemployment. And then we try to come up with these general laws about these abstract quantities that tell us how they work, and then we can use those laws to predict them. And what I think Arnold's trying to argue right now is those laws are very, well, let me let you not put words in your mouth, but the laws themselves are highly changing.
Yeah, they're changing. They're changing, and we don't know them for certain. I mean, if you were to ask me to describe my views on how the macroeconomy works, I would actually give you a probability distribution about various propositions.
But so you're a Bayesian.
That's still getting ahead. Frank Pearson, that freshman year teacher, had a great way of describing the basic Keynesian model. He kept using the term injections and leakages. So you can think of spending as a stream, and you want the stream to be flowing. The more the stream flows, you know, the more economic activity there is. And there are things that inject spending into the stream, like business fixed investment, when businesses invest in plant and machinery, you know, and so on, or if people invest in houses, that injects spending into the stream. And there are leakages out of the spending stream that are personal saving or taxes. And so, again, it gives a nice, seemingly simple way to describe how the economy works, except that, by the way, it's completely different from the way that's described in microeconomics, in which there are prices that regulate the various markets. There are no prices in freshman macroeconomics. People don't respond. They don't move from one sector to another based on relative prices. That's all in the background. Somehow we're now in this world of injections and leakages and no prices. Anyway, so it was all very credible, or seemingly credible. And by the way, one of the tools, you know, we talked about fiscal and monetary policy, but one of the tools that was part of the toolkit, according to the economics when I learned it, was something called incomes policy.
Yeah, I learned that too.
So a government would set wage and price guideposts. The thinking was that if left to themselves, unions would try to bid up wages, and there would be kind of a beggar thy neighbor thing where one union would bid up wages and then the other would have to bid up wages, and neither one would end up ahead when it was all said and done. And so the government could solve that problem. And it was in the fall of 1971 that Richard Nixon tried to implement that with wage price controls and then subsequent wage price policies. And the 70s proved to be a disastrous period for macroeconomics, or for macroeconomic policy. We had much more inflation than had been expected and ultimately much more unemployment than had been expected. People talked about the misery index of adding up inflation and unemployment, and you got misery indexes of 15% or more. So I think the economics profession changed its views on macroeconomics. And I think the next phase I would describe as monetarism. And that was a belief that, well, you really couldn't have, you couldn't control unemployment quite as well as you thought, but you could control inflation really well. And the way to do that was to have a steady rate of money growth. And by this time I was in graduate school, and I, in my own mind, was still somewhat of a Keynesian. And in fact, I'd been learning to use these big macroeconometric models, which use hundreds of equations and so on. And of course, they and I that was still kind of my background. Even leaving grad school, I went to work at the Federal Reserve, where they had like the probably the most well-respected macroeconomic model, macroeconometric model. But I kept reading all these papers that said, that demonstrated that these models were not working. The idea is that you want to treat different periods of time as equivalent to each other so that they can act like controlled experiments for each other. You know, in economics, you'd love to have controlled experiments, but there aren't. And
In fact, I want to talk about that when we talk about macroeconometrics, because that's one of my biggest issues with trying to do macroeconometrics, is we don't have experiments. We have one set of data, and everyone knows what it is. So it's kind of silly to build a model and then test it against it. But we can get to that later.
So even aside from the sort of the refitting of data, people were finding that, that just compared to very naive... the findings as I understood, were that you really couldn't make the 1950s comparable to the 1990s and so on. And for example, an example I often use is that our labor force is very different. In 1950, let's say 80% of the labor force had only a high school education or less, and now it's two-thirds have at least some college. So it's a completely different labor force, and yet... the macroeconometric project is an attempt to somehow treat those two time periods as equivalent. So the models didn't work well, so they're kind of discredited, and people formed this kind of loose monetarist view. And then the monetarist view began to acquire more and more confidence in the 1980s, because Paul Volcker at the Fed was able to control inflation by tightening up on money, by raising interest rates. He was able to tame the inflation beast that had been raging in the 70s. And then generally from about the mid-80s until just a couple years ago, we had a very moderate economy. People referred to the Great Moderation. And so macroeconomics at an academic level went off into doing abstract mathematics of optimizing consumers, and I wouldn't want to even try to explain what it was doing or why it was trying to do it, but
they were trying to be microeconomists.
In some sense, Paul Krugman refers to it as a dark age, and on this one I agree with him. I think it was just a dark age. It didn't produce any enlightenment, and from a policy point of view, there was this just belief that, well, if you keep money growth steady, it looks like the economy is fine. Now, those two things... I have no idea whether money growth is steady. I'm a real skeptic of monetarism, because I just don't think that there's any stable definition of money. That is, if government really cracks down on one thing and says, this is money and it's only going to grow at this rate, and the financial sector wants to do something different, they'll find a close substitute for what the government is trying to control, at least at lower moderate inflation rates. So I'm an old-fashioned anti-monetarist. that kind of anti-monetarism was around in the late 60s and early 70s, and I've never really lost it. But because of the observation that we had this great moderation, that is, periods of mostly economic growth with very few recessions, very mild recessions between the mid-80s and about 2007. Because we had that period, people said, monetarism obviously works. We must be doing monetarism, and monetarism must be working. And then in my view is that what's happened in the last year or two is outside of the predictions of any of these sort of monetarist models or any macro model that you would have had. And so we have to start all over again to try to figure out macroeconomics. I think we're kind of at square one. So that I'll drop it there, and that's where I see it.
Well, I'm not ready to condemn the whole field, but I'm with you in a lot of ways. Let me go through my experience briefly. I learned the Keynesian model as an undergraduate. We read Joan Robinson's Little Blue Book, and it was purely Keynesian, even when I got to grad school. So I was in undergraduate in the 70s, hit grad school at the beginning of the 80s. I should have been learning about the new classical model and some of the problems with the Keynesian model, but I guess where I went, we didn't learn that. And it was pretty Keynesian. It really wasn't until I got out of grad school that it started getting into these new modern, new classical sort of... The new classical model, for everyone who's out there that wonders what that is, that's a model where the main thing that drives fluctuations in the economy is information. People are confused. They don't have the information they need to make the right decisions, and those information problems drive business cycles. So that was really the dominant model I learned in grad school.
Can I interrupt there? Because the information that information structure is really kind of stupid in those models. The information that people lack is they can't predict what the Fed's going to do. And that's the only reason there's any unemployment in those models. And I think that's
what killed them. I mean, they couldn't explain either the duration. They couldn't explain why markets for information didn't arise. If you're a Chicago economist, you've got to answer the question, well, how come a market for information doesn't arise if information is so important? So there were all kinds of problems with that model. I'm actually more of a new Keynesian guy, at least I was until more recently. So, yeah, where I got shocked, so I learned these models, and then we had this financial crisis, and I learned all that, I taught my undergraduates, there's these government multipliers, and we talked about fine-tuning, and here's how it works, and here's how you fix the economy that has problems, and we're all confident, and we'd cite multipliers of 1.93 and all this sort of thing. The sort of precision that you were railing against a while back.
So
I learned it.
Can I get you to explain what a multiplier is, since we're not assuming any knowledge?
It's the impact of a dollar's worth of government spending. So it's the bang per buck. So a multiplier 1.93 means if you spend a dollar, it ends up generating $1.93 in GDP. And those multipliers are behind a lot of the fiscal policy that we're seeing as a means of stimulating the economy. But I don't think we need to throw out the whole field as much as you do. I think we really ask the wrong questions. I think I'm with you on the great moderation. I think the great moderation gave economists way too much confidence. So the great moderation happened in 1984, and the variance of GDP fell 50%. Inflation stabilized at a low level. We had these fights about whether it was economic policy or technology, but most people thought it was probably policy. And they thought it was probably the Fed. So the Fed was using these new modern techniques that Arnold described, and somehow it was managing to stabilize the economy, bring us low inflation, and everything was wonderful. I was you use what's called a Taylor rule to stabilize the economy if you're the Fed. I was a Taylor rule advocate. I was with all that. Then the financial crisis hit, and I guess that really kind of shook my world up a little bit. I reached into my tool bag that I had been teaching for so many years and learning for so many years and started to say, okay, what does this tool bag have to say about how to solve this crisis? I'll draw graphs for people. I'll show them what economists know. We'll come up with a prescription, and we'll be able to tell people how to solve this thing. But as you start doing that, as you actually have to put your own reputation on the line behind these things, you start to realize that the models, we just weren't asking the right questions. The fundamental mechanism, the models we were using was relative prices. The price of eggs in terms of the price of bacon would get stuck. It wouldn't move fast enough. And that somehow would cause economic fluctuations. But I just don't think that's the fundamental mechanism. I don't think that's the question we should have been asking if you want to deal with a crisis like we have now. So I see us as getting way overconfident, trying to become scientists, trying to become microeconomists. We're trying to pursue the scientific method, make economics into a science. We're doing all this mathematical physics stuff. We're doing these simulations and worrying about stability and all sorts of mathematical concepts. But in the meantime, we're forgetting to ask the important questions, like what is a stable system? How could it crack up like we've just seen? And I just think now we're left in a place where we need to go back and start over, not be mathematical and technical for the sake of mathematical and being technical, but rather to ask the questions we need to ask, the questions we learn we need to ask from this crisis, and rebuild models that are actually useful for policy, models that we can use to that we can rely upon, that tell us something we need to know. I mean, it's nice to do all this theory, and it's nice to sort of understand how to construct these theoretical constructs. But when it comes to doing actual policy in the real world, they really don't do you a lot of good. And so I'm hoping we can back up and start to solve some of those problems.
Yeah, I would say as a matter of practice, what people are falling back on is, you know, all the way back to the 60s, kind of like that first book I learned out of. There's some probability that that's right, as again, my probability distribution, but I worry. And I like what your point about asking the questions. To me, the two questions are, how does the financial sector relate to the non-financial sector? You know, the classic, you know, Wall Street-Main Street relationship. And I think there's room for a lot of disagreement about that. And then there's the question of how does the economy gets stuck at high rates of unemployment, you know, and
what do you do about it?
And my answer on the unemployment is that when we find ourselves with a misallocation of resources that's large. Okay, back up. Let's say normal times. In normal times, jobs are shifting all the time. If you look at a history of the telecommunications industry over the last 20 years, you'd see hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of jobs destroyed in telecommunications. I mean, you know, I don't know, 50 years ago we had lots of telephone operators, maybe even 30 years ago. Well, even 20 years ago at businesses, you'd had a lot of human telephone operators. And, of course, you had people servicing pay telephones. Pay telephones were still growing, you know, 20 years ago. So we've had hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of jobs destroyed. But we've had hundreds of thousands of new jobs created, people working on cell phones, people who are installing fiber optics. We just got that at my house. I'm not sure I'm happy with it yet, but that's a side issue. So we've created hundreds of thousands of jobs, we destroyed hundreds of thousands of jobs, and that works well in normal times, and markets seem to operate well in normal times. But it seems that when there's a big misallocation of resources, so I think we've had too many people and too many talented people in financial services
and also
making
building
up these
houses.
Securities, and too many people building houses, at least as of a few years ago, maybe too many people involved in creating and operating shopping malls. I think that's like the next crash on the horizon, but that's a separate issue. So we have these misallocations of resources, but instead of jobs being created and people moving into those jobs as the jobs are lost, the job loss either is so rapid or there's so little expansion in the expanding sectors that instead of the loss of jobs showing up as an increase in jobs elsewhere, it shows up as a net loss of jobs. And so I don't know everything about how that happens, you know, how in a recessionary economy a gross loss of jobs becomes a net loss of jobs, whereas that doesn't seem to happen in a normal growing economy. But that's one of the questions. How is there unemployment? And then the other
question... I think you're right. When this first started, that was one of the things I had worried about. If you have these resource misallocations, which I think is a big part of a bubble, how do you move those resources fast enough to stop a big crash? And if you can't move those resources fast enough, can you create opportunities for these people to do something in the meantime while still keeping the flow into the new sectors that you need without distorting those flows into the new sectors? And I think that's a really hard problem to both support the people you need to support who aren't getting absorbed fast enough and not distort the flows going into the new sectors. And so I think I'm with you in a lot of ways here.
And that doesn't sound as simple as just sort of pushing a thruster of fiscal policy, throwing general spending at it. Maybe it will work. You would think that if people used to build houses...
If it creates jobs. I haven't been happy with the... They haven't focused enough, in my opinion, on the actual job creation component of the stimulus package. Anyway, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, that's okay. So, and the other question then that's, I think, even more difficult is the relationship of the financial sector to the non-financial sector. I'd say the most economists think that it's important and that we need to restart the financial sector.
But when you ask them what has the financial sector done for the real economy, they don't have a good answer. And I think that's your point.
Yeah, I think, what I came up with is maybe a simple description of the non-financial sector. Those of us who are not in the financial sector would love to have as our assets risk-free stuff, checking accounts that we can touch at any time. We would love to have as our liabilities long-term risky liabilities. So I would like to plant fruit trees. I would like to issue debt to finance them. Or I would like to buy a house and issue debt to finance that. The point is, I want to hold that asset for a long time, and I want to issue long-term debt. So picture this: everyone in the non-financial sector is entrepreneurs. They want to issue long-term risky debt. I mean, if you're an entrepreneur, every debt you issue is risky, and you want it to be long-term. You don't want to be called in right away. As a consumer, you want something like a checking account where you can use it anytime you want and where it's risk-free. So that's the non-financial sector, and the financial sector sort of rises to meet that demand. That means they have to hold the opposite side. They have to hold the long-term risky debt of the entrepreneurs and issue the short-term riskless debt, the checking accounts that consumers want. So the bigger the financial sector gets, the bigger the non-financial sector can get. As the financial sector expands, the non-financial sector can build more houses, plant more fruit trees, make more long-term investments. So that's my picture of how they relate to each other. But that still raises all sorts of questions of why did the financial sector get too big, up until a few years ago. And why does it seem too small now, or is it too small now, or is it the right size now? How do we know that?
And I'm not sure we know the answer to that question. And this gets to me a little bit at this notion of diagnostics. So one thing we've been hearing, we should pop bubbles, we shouldn't let this happen. But you need diagnostics, and I'm not sure we have really, really good diagnostics to know, what's the proper size of the financial sector, when's it too big, when's it too small, and all those sorts of questions. So I agree with you there.
But I think that's actually going to be the key question in macroeconomics going forward, or a key question. I think the two key questions are, how do you reemploy people, especially in an environment we have today? In the Great Depression, you could count on anything that increased the demand for manual labor was going to reemploy people. Now, if you can get somewhere out of increasing the demand for manual labor, but I keep saying that you're not going to have unemployed investment bankers out there driving bulldozers on construction projects. So I think a key question for macro going forward is going to be how, in a specialized, educated labor force, do you stimulate reemployment? And then this other question of, as you said, how do you decide how big, when the financial sector has gotten too big or too small, And I don't think we know today. I think the consensus is that right now it's too small, so everyone says we need more lending, we need to recapitalize the banks. What they're saying is we need a larger financial sector.
Yeah.
I'm a minority view on this, and I claim I'm basing my views on the views of Hyman Minsky, who's a kind of a heterodox Keynesian, who said that that you go through phases in the financial sector where there's conservative finance in the conservative phase. He called it hedge finance. There's speculative finance in a more normal setting, and then there's Ponzi finance when people get euphoric. And then when the Ponzi finance crashes, they go back to the most conservative hedge finance. And in hedge finance, he said we need profits, that firms are only going to fund their investment out of profit. So I'm taking that idea seriously, and I'm saying that instead of imagining we're going to sort of reverse some of the damage in the financial sector and go back to funding investment with lots of debt, I'm saying we're going to have to fund investment going forward out of profits. And so that says you should focus on profits in the non-financial sector rather than expansion of the financial sector. It makes sense to me, but I think there are very few people making that, that point of view.
When I think about the financial sector, we can't go back to the economy we had before. So I think it does have to shrink some. So I don't have any doubt that the size has to be smaller than what we had before. What I'm less certain about is the complexity. What we've gotten from securitization and the extent to which regulation or some other means, maybe the private sector will just decide these things are poison and we don't want them, and that'll take care of the problem by itself. But to what degree has the complexity itself, it's not just the size, I'm not so sure that it did, it's also the complexity of these financial assets and whether that's been a problem, whether we need to worry about that and how we model that complexity, how we keep track of the complexity, all those sorts of problems I think are important too. And another question within the finance. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I agree that the what the financial sector looks like and what kind of regulations it look like, I think that's going to be the dominant focus of macroeconomics, whereas we've spent the last 20 years writing down mathematical models of monetary policy and tax, whether tax cuts make a difference. I think we're going to put most of that energy into financial regulation. I was just reading a paper today where the guy cited John Kenneth Galbraith to the effect that, every financial innovation is just another way to create debt. So it's a thought to consider. Can I just put you on the spot a little bit? Do you think that the bank bailouts are necessary?
Not in every case. I think stabilizing the system is necessary, and I think some of the bank bailouts are necessary of the big ones. I wish we had better measures of the interconnectedness so they could be more certain that there really is a systemic risk. So I really do think that we need to worry about systemic risk and collapse, and that the Fed did have to intervene, and that by intervening they probably did actually prevent a big collapse. For me, the question is, when can the system begin to handle these things on their own? In fact, I had this question when Lehman came up. I can't say I was the one who totally opposed them letting Lehman fail. What I said was a real wishy-washy. I'm not so sure it's soon enough that the system can absorb this failure, that it's ready to absorb the failure. And I'm still not sure we're there, but I think we're getting a lot closer than we used to be. So, yes, I think we did need to bail out some of these banks. I'm not real happy with the form of the bailout in a lot of ways, but I think the actual principle of bailout was necessary. What I'm having a hard time is knowing when that principle ends, because it can't go on forever. And this gets back to the next time this happens, we need to have plans on the shelf where the rules are well known to everyone playing the game. They need to know how long the support will last. They need to know what the government's going to do. They need to know what the orderly dissolution of a bank's going to be, so it doesn't look like an ad hoc procedure every point along the way. And so I have a lot of problems with the way it was handled, but in terms of was it necessary, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I keep hoping that it wasn't. well, be, you know, for a variety
you
of reasons.
You seem to go both directions when I was reading it. First it was, yeah, we need to do this, and then you backed off, and I'm not sure where you're at today.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I come at this from my Midwestern sensibility and just sort of, gosh, of all the people we ought to be throwing money at, these big banks, I keep trying to come up with arguments for why it wouldn't be necessary. So maybe that's why I'm attracted to this idea of
I've come to realize over time was that it's not just the bank balance sheets. You know, at first I was against tax cuts. But I've come around on that. This is something I wrote about recently, that household balance sheets have also taken a great big hit. And we don't just need to rebuild the financial sector balance sheets before the economy can recover. Households aren't going to go out and buy big ticket items as long as their retirement funds are wiped out, as long as their savings are wiped out. So we're going to see households, I think, rebuilding, refilling their coffers, rebuilding their savings. And it's not until that's finished that the economy can truly recover. And so I think tax cuts and other things can be used to help the households rebuild their, recapitalize households essentially. And the sooner we recapitalize those households, the sooner the end of this thing is going to come. And so I think we spent too much time perhaps on bank recapitalization and not enough time thinking about household recapitalization myself.
Yeah, and the worry is that long-term we're decapitalizing households at some point.
Yeah. Well, they probably need to have more savings to some extent. Yeah.
All right. Should we go on to your next one?
Sure. Let's see, what was next? We kind of got into Treasury and Fed. We're going to talk about macroeconometrics a little bit, the Treasury and the Fed a little more. We can do either one. I don't have a lot to say on macroeconometrics. I was just going to make the point. So this is, for anyone out there wondering what the heck that word means, this is just using statistics to try to learn about the economy. And normally what you would do if you were a scientist, you would go out and do experiments in a laboratory, and you use the outcome of those experiments to learn about the world. And you could control the laboratory environment so that only two things are changing at once. So you change one thing, you change the treatment, and you watch the response. And because it's a laboratory, you're able to control and hold all else equal. Macroeconomists, A, can't do experiments. And that's a big problem for us. We have one set of data, one economy. There's one U.S. economy. It's run once, and that's the data that we have. And we have to do the best we can with that. And as I said earlier, we know what that data says. We know when the recessions were. We know the correlations that you have to explain. You know, we know that wages and productivity have to be pro-cyclical, at least not counter-cyclical. We know all the little things, the bells and whistles these models have to have. So it's hard to build a model that doesn't fit. And so I think there's a real problem with validating these models against the data once we actually build them. And I guess that's my biggest rap against macroeconometrics is this idea that we're actually learning much from one experiment. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I think that the way I think of macroeconometric models is that they are simulation models. Think of something where you start down and you start out and you say, well, I'm going to make some guesses as to a set of equations that describes the economy. And then I'm going to run a simulation and see how well it replicates some actual behavior. And then I'll tweak the parameters in my simulation model until I get something I'm happy with.
Exactly.
I don't think that you get something much different out of any of the supposedly statistical methodologies other than that. So it's a classic case of the models... description of reality is what you built into it to begin with. It really isn't being provided by the data, and I don't think the data are capable of providing it. So I think that's frustrating, again, for the people who want to think of it like physics. And then the other thing that's, I think, disturbing is the phenomenon that I refer to as structural change. You cannot predict a 2008 financial crisis using the statistical data. There's some major structural change occurred when people all of a sudden decided that the amount of risk that they were holding was way too much. It's sort of like it's another Paul Krugman metaphor of Wile E. Coyote runs over the cliff And he's still spinning his legs, and all of a sudden he notices he's past the cliff, and then he goes crashing down. That's just a very... That, of course, defies the laws of physics in Wile E. Coyote terms, but you can't describe that behavior in terms of laws that look like laws of physics.
Yeah. Turning points... See, that goes back to the financial sector. Turning points are really, really hard to predict, even for scientists. You know, when exactly a piece of plastic will break is a tough equation, tough prediction to make.
That's a good analogy.
I think this goes back to your idea about the connection between the financial sector and the real sector. I do think, though, we have some chance at some point in time of using these tools and maybe even using data to understand when the financial sector is in danger of a collapse. Because our models really didn't have that kind of collapse in them. I think we got to the point through our econometrics and through our theoretical models where we thought we were so smart and the economy was so smart and there was so much technological change that the kind of collapse we've seen just couldn't happen. We just didn't even think it could happen. So the idea that we could build it either to our theoretical or empirical models, it just wasn't there.
Yeah, and I think the mindset was that even if something sort of bad happened, that, again, there was this monetarist view that we could make up for it. I think the view, you know, go back to the dot-com
crash. It was Greenspan's,
we'll
clean it up after with a sponge. We'll just go out with a sponge and mop it up.
Right, and that's what we thought happened after the dot-com crash. You know, Greenspan lowered interest rates, and we survived the dot-com crash. But it could be that the reason we survived the dot-com crash, you know, is something else entirely. Maybe there's the fact that it was stocks. Actually, Robert Merton suggests that the reason that we survived the dot-com crash is that we didn't have time to get used to all that wealth that was created. It was created so suddenly that people didn't really adjust their behavior to it. So when it went away, it was like people never lost. Whereas the housing wealth people accumulated over a period of years. And then when that fell off, people felt it more. Although, I think...
I can remember just laughing. I had my house appraised, but I had to send in a kid to college. And I had no clue. I just laughed. You can't be serious. It's not worth that much. But if you want to lend me money, sure, I'll take it.
Yeah. But that's a... And I think there's a little bit of that, too. I don't think we believe... You know, I think it took a while for people to... factor in the increases in their housing prices, and to the extent that there was this huge final hockey stick run-up in house prices in 2005-2006, I don't think people had really factored that in either. So I'm not sure Merton has a complete
story. Yeah, that's kind of what I was saying, too, I think.
Yeah. All right, you want to go into your what you would do at Treasury or Fed question?
Sure. We can do that.
All right. What would you do if you were some kind of economic czar?
Oh, man. I was hoping you'd go first so I could think about a better answer. I think the Treasury and the Fed both, the Fed in particular, misdiagnosed this problem initially. And so they treated it as a liquidity problem, purely as a liquidity problem. They worried about freeing up funds and getting the flow of funds going in. And it took us a little while to realize that the reason we were having a liquidity problem, the reason there was so much fear out there was because there were so many losses.
So what's the difference between a liquidity problem and a solvency problem? Let's get that one out there.
Well, that's what I think I'm saying, is the solvency problem drove the liquidity problem. And so we thought just by providing money to people... Go ahead.
I was asking you to just take a time out and define solvency and liquidity in case people don't know what those terms are.
Okay. I'm sorry. Liquidity is just how easily you can convert an asset into cash. And so the lot next door, if you own it, might not be very liquid because if you needed the cash this afternoon, it might take you several months to sell that lot. A treasury bond is highly liquid because you can sell it right away. On the market. And so how fast you can convert an asset to cash is its liquidity. Solvency is just the idea of whether you can pay your bills or not. So when you're insolvent, your bills are bigger than your ability to pay them. Your assets are less than your liabilities. initially I think they misdiagnosed this as purely funds were just frozen. And so all we need to do is get those funds unfrozen and everything will fix itself. But what they, I think, realized after a while was it wasn't just that funds were frozen, it was also this solvency issue that banks had taken a lot of losses on their balance sheet, and you needed to solve the solvency issue to get rid of the liquidity issue. I think, though, there's also the question of toxic assets on the bank balance sheets. So I think really that's the key to all the fear. And until that's cleared out, until that problem's gone, we're going to be stuck with an underperforming financial sector. So the key to getting everything working again in the financial sector is to get those toxic assets off the balance sheets. And you can do that through nationalization. You can buy them directly. You can do public-private partnerships. My own view is nationalization is the surest, quickest, most certain way to get it done. Let's just do it, get it over with. Get the good assets in one pile, bad assets in another pile. Take over the banks, make the two piles, sell the good ones back to the public, and be done with it. But for me, that's the first and the most important thing. We absolutely have to somehow get that done, get those assets off the balance sheets. Then we have to capitalize to the extent that we want the banks recapitalized. This is your size question. And we have to get the real economy reseeded somehow through fiscal or monetary policy. But for me, the whole key comes down to those toxic assets.
I think it's interesting that this view that we ought to, you know, get the banks sorted out, you know, nationalization is one term, or, you know, quasi-bankruptcy or FDIC liquidation, you know, whatever term you want to use, that's something that's advocated across the political spectrum. You know, you and I disagree politically on a lot of things, but we agree on that.
Yeah.
And it's advocated by what I call the peanut gallery. That is, it's advocated by a lot of people outside government, and it's left and right. And it's just an interesting observation. The people inside the government seem to think that that's a horrible idea. Maybe it's because they're actually on the brink. They're always on the brink of doing it, but it's one of these things that's like an option that they don't yet want to exercise. But as long as they don't feel like exercising it, they have to act like they'll never exercise it. I don't know how else to explain this huge difference.
Well, I think the nationalization is going to cost a lot of money, and they're worried about how much it's going to cost. So they're trying this public-private partnership, which they, if it works, you're going to get away with it spending a lot less money as a government. But I just don't think the risk you're taking is worth the money you're saving. That's my view.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. I think where we're more likely to disagree is sort of, you know, how to kickstart the economy from the employment perspective.
Yeah.
I go back to the, you know, first of all, I don't want to, you know, have heavy concentration of power. Second of all, I would love to use monetary policy, except I don't believe in it. I just think that, you know, I think it's a little bit of, you know, belief in voodoo magic. I don't think we actually, I just have this old-fashioned anti-monetarist view. So if I don't want to increase government spending, and I don't want to I don't have confidence in monetary policy, I pretty much fall back on cutting taxes, and my favorite is the cutting the employer portion of the payroll tax, which would initially raise demand for labor. It's a neutral way, in terms of not picking winners or losers, of putting money in the hands of non-financial firms and hoping that we'll generate expansion there. But I don't claim any strong scientific basis for that. It's a little bit process of elimination. I don't like the other policies. It's a little bit my interpretation of Minsky's story that we need business profits when we're at a point of very low confidence, a general decline in confidence. We need to build up profits. And just the idea that, well, if you cut the employer portion of the payroll tax, if nothing else, you're going to make them want to demand more workers. So that's what I would do if I were in there.
You know, I like the payroll tax idea in a lot of ways. My one concern is once you cut a tax, once you increase spending, it's really hard to reverse. And since this has to do with Social Security and other sorts of programs, one wonders if it might not undermine in the long run the funding of Social Security. And so if we could do this and call it something else other than a relieving of the payroll tax, but have it be exactly the same thing, just for the political optics, then I think I'm with you a lot more. If you understand
so you'd rather do an employment subsidy.
Yeah, and, you know, just call it, call it something else. But it's the same exact thing.
Right.
Just design the program so that money actually flows and just give them another flow back in the other direction to offset it.
Yeah.
Rather than literally cutting. I know it's the same thing, but the political optics there I think are important. And I think there's a lot of people worried that this is the first step to sort of trying to eliminate Social Security. Even though that's not what's going on here, I think that's the opposition that I heard on that idea. But, I think why not help the people that are struggling? I think that's a good idea. My view is monetary policy, we're out of bullets there. I've never thought monetary policy was going to do much good from the beginning. I don't think monetary policy is a very good tool for getting you out of recessions. I think it's a wonderful tool for slowing down an overheated economy. When you raise interest rates, you can choke off investment. When you lower interest rates, I'm not sure you can stimulate it or consumption. Yeah. And so I don't like the idea of making people spend by creating massive inflations and things like that, because you devalue other assets when you do those sorts of things. And so I'm just not thinking that monetary policy is going to work. But I don't have a lot to say for the reasons we talked about earlier. Our models are bad, our econometrics don't, even if they were good, we don't have data from periods like this to calibrate our models. So we don't know a lot about how to solve these kinds of problems from historical record anyway. And so will government spending work? Maybe. Will tax cuts work? Maybe. Will monetary policy work? Maybe, but I'm less sure. So what should we do? Well, for me, I'd rather do more too much than too little, so I take a portfolio approach. Let's do government spending, let's do taxation, let's do monetary policy, and if we figure out what one works, we'll pull back on the others and we'll double down on the one that's working. But I think a portfolio approach with plenty thrown at each option is probably our best bet at this point.
Okay, so if we've solved all the problems, are we finished?
I think we've solved them all. You know, people would just listen to you and me.
Okay,
we
great.
We wouldn't have these troubles.
All right, we should really market this. All right. So, okay, bye, Mark.
Well, thank you. Bye.
Bye.